Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And this is The Food Fight, a frank discussion of food culture featuring Australia's top chefs, producers and experts.
We'll chat about real issues and go places others won't.
This podcast travels throughout the country and we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather and speak.
And we pay respect to elders past, present and emerging.
This episode we're chatting with Steve Folletti from Moonlight Flat Oysters in Batemans Bay about his journey into becoming an oyster farmer, how he measures, manages and maintains quality, the way the service of oysters has changed over the years and the role he's played in that, and about his award-winning Oyster Matching Borrowed Cuttings Pick Pull wine. Steve Folletti, thanks for joining me on The Food Fight.
Great to be here.
A bit of a spur of the moment one, being down here stuck on the south, well not stuck on the south coast, it's kind of nice to be here, but I'm spending a bit of extra time down here while Wollongong's in lockdown.
Doing it tough at Batemans Bay.
Yeah, doing it so tough. I mean, God, we live in a nice place down here, don't we? We're going to talk all about oysters today, and I'm really looking forward to it. We met when I put together the South Coast Cookbook in 2015, yep. The South Coast Cookbook 2. Yep. And to this day, you handed me the single greatest oyster I've eaten in my life, which was the which was a Clair de Lune that you just took out of one of the trays on the flat, on Moonlight Flat, and shucked for me and said, help yourself. And I got a few more. I was lucky enough to get a few more that day as well.
That's
and
good.
I tell you what, that experience, Yeah, again, I mean, it's all a sort of a time and place sort of thing.
Terrific that you still remember it.
That's, oh, mate, it was the best. It was the best. I was like, this is the best job in the world right now. Like right now, I have the best job in the world. But I think there's so much to get to, and luckily with this podcast, we've got so much time to get through it all. But to start, we'll lead on to the story of Moonlight Flat and your story as an oyster grower. But I think I mean, back in the day, remembering my dad and the way that his mates and stuff used to eat oysters and that sort of thing, our culture of the traditional, it's not nice to say traditional, but the Australian culture of eating oysters at pubs and RSL clubs and places like that, I think things are changing a lot now in the way that restaurants are serving oysters and preparing oysters. But To give us a bit of a background, why don't we start in France, where you've spent a lot of time looking at oyster farms, oyster practices, and oyster culture. Do you want to just tell us a bit about how it differs, or what you first saw and how you first became interested in French oyster culture?
Yeah, well, I've always had in mind that France is really the powerhouse of oysters, not so much in tonnage production, which is pretty much middle of the globe in the level of production, but in presentation, table experience, marketing through the marketing and handling and logistics through the chain. And the major fundamental difference between France and Australia, or the European Union and Australia, is the law that says it's illegal to sell dead oysters, and every box of oysters that are put on the market in France contains the bottom line: these coquillage, these shellfish, must be alive at the time of sale. Same in Britain. You'll see the same thing on boxes of oysters there. In Australia, that's not the case. And indeed, for people who want to sell pre-shucked dead oysters, there is a regulation in the food, in the State Food Act, that says these oysters must be opened under a sprinkling rose of potable water. I've raised this difference with various ministers and a whole range of people till I'm hoarse in the voice of pushing it.
Yeah, you were talking about it in 2015 when we first met.
I've been saying it for 21 years. I'll go to my grave and it'll still be the same. It's too hard to turn the battleship around. I'm only one voice. But that is essentially the difference. In France, to get back to France, if there are no oysters in the marketplace at Christmas time in France, there'll be a revolution. My personal observation would put oyster consumption or oyster participation in France at about 98% of the population. In Australia, my estimate is probably something more like 20%, 25%. Yep. And that is the fundamental reason, because people in Australia have had a bad experience or it's not part of the home kitchen culture. And indeed, you can see it in the language, in that we've all heard this one. Workers in an office, Bill's not come in today, he's sick. Why is he sick? Must have been the crook oyster. Hey, blame the old oyster.
I know a lot of people have been through it.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. I still hear this all the time.
Yeah. We actually, a little side anecdote, but this very house here in Browley, my dad's ex-partner now, we can talk about it, but we went to a local restaurant and got some oysters and things like that, and everyone was talking about how much they love natural oysters and beautiful. I was quite young at the time, and we came back here and everyone went to bed and things like that in the middle of the night.
Oh no.
And the poor thing was up all night hugging the toilet.
Yeah.
It doesn't get much worse than that. Sorry to put you off your train of thought.
No, but you would not be surprised to learn the frequency with which those anecdotes, which I hear those anecdotes all the time. We were having a wine tasting thing in a professional place with a lot of professional young people the other day, and the hostess was talking and drinking the wine, well, having the wine, and I said, well, let's have some oysters, and, you know, here's an oyster. And she says, well, actually, I don't eat the oysters. I don't eat oysters. I can't, because, you know, I had a bad experience. And I'm thinking, man, and you're the sommelier in this restaurant, and how are you going to lead people through to our dedicated oyster wine, seafood wine that we've, brought to to the marketplace.
Yeah.
It really is a tragedy that we have this wonderful exotic oyster in Australia. It occurs nowhere else in the world. People around the world aren't aware of our oyster.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a few people in Singapore and Japan, the ones that have been initiated, do, or the occasional tourists. British people do. But if you pick up the bulk of oyster books and oyster literature around the world that claim to be a snapshot of, you know, world oysters, none of them mention the Australian oyster.
Mm, that's interesting.
Mm.
Yeah. So, I mean, this sort of contrast between the participation in France and in Australia is interesting, and I think some of it can definitely be placed on people having bad experiences and people, you know, the crook oysters that you talk about. But what else is it? There's got to be something else there, because I do know people who have one of the interesting things I find about oysters, they're a very special, you know, very special food. It's sitting above a lot of others. I think that when fresh oysters are opened, you know, around the table at home or at Christmas or on a menu at a restaurant or whatever, it's something that's just a little bit special and a bit different. And I know people who tell me they wish they liked oysters,
yeah,
because they can see how much people who like them enjoy them, but they just can't get there.
Yeah. And you're getting into deeper territory now.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Do you think these, just, you know, if you start feeding them to kids in France, then they're just more likely to like them when they're older.
Yeah. Well, what you're touching on is this dark, sensual, mysterious aura that oysters present to people.
Mm.
Imaginary or otherwise, but oh, these things are raw, they're dangerous, but, you know, I'm told they're really objects of passion and, you know, they fire you up, all this sort of mysterious stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what gets people in. And one observation I'll make over some years, have you ever noticed in a lot of food media how many times opened oysters appear as a photograph to get people in as opposed to any other food commodity, whether it's a big steak or anything else?
Yeah.
You do a count and you'll find that oysters are way beyond their proportionate relevance to the food scene.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's good, right, because they're very, very photogenic.
Yep. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, fascinating. I think sensual is actually a good word to use. Mysterious and intriguing, all those types of things. What did you... Let's talk a bit about what you've... No, let's talk about when you first decided or became interested in oyster production and how that decision was made and sort of how your journeys in France sort of influenced that.
Sure. So I fell into production accidentally. I first tasted an oyster when I was 14. So I grew up in the country and we had friends who had a holiday house at Burra Lake. And in those days, there used to be a public oyster lease there. And my mother said, look, here's a jar. And she was a city girl transplanted to the bush. Here's a jar. When you go on holidays with your friends, go down to that public lease and fill this full of oysters and salt water and bring it home. And I was thinking, oh, oysters, yuck, you know. And so my friend and I are stuck in on a middle of a summer day, very hot, very thirsty, very hungry, opening oysters, putting them in the jar with salt water for mum. And I started to get very hungry. And I thought, oh, look, I'll just try one of these. And the longer story, mum didn't get anything.
Oh, really? Wow. First go.
Yeah.
Didn't even take too much.
I was hungry. I was thirsty. And then I got it.
Yeah, right.
So I've always liked oysters. And then my folks moved down to Batemans Bay in the late 60s. And so this notionally... this area has always been home while we lived overseas for quite some time, a couple of decades. So this was sort of our expatriate home. And so I always used to get a refill of oysters every time I came home. And then one day I was sitting up in our office in Tokyo in the three-man businessman suit, as a salary man suit, thinking, I wonder how much oyster leases sell for. You know, it'd be a great place to go fishing. And so I did a bit of research, and when I came home next time, I spoke to a few people in fisheries, and there was a ridiculously cheap, well, I thought were ridiculously cheap, rundown farm going for sale. So I bought it and did nothing with it except come and eat the oysters every time I came home, or took a few back to Japan where our office colleagues would rip our arm off to get to the oysters. That was pretty good. Until we finished the expatriate life, came home, and I thought, well, what am I going to do with these oyster leases? And I thought, maybe it'd be a good marketing exercise, and that's what I was doing in East Asia, Japan, China, and Taiwan and Korea. And so basically brought and applied every trick in the book, every technique, every sort of strategy that we had been using with a different commodity in Japan to the oysters. And to begin with, for example, branding products and having brands that stood for something in the marketplace and differentiating them from what in those days was big, bulk, undifferentiated commodity, just like potatoes in a sack or lumps of coal, you know, put into bags, kiss goodbye, no customer relationship, no trace back, nothing, see you later. Any quality will do. And we just changed all that into a Japanese level of standard for food and made a connection with the end customer. We only did direct business with chefs, cut out the middlemen completely because that's only an extra pair of hands in delivery time. And, you know, there's a few questionable practices that were prevailing at the time that I didn't like, and I didn't want my brands sort of besmirched by anybody else's actions.
Mm.
And so we really brought restaurants to the point where they sold by the piece, which was a big shock for the end customer because they started having to pay.
I remember seeing it for the first time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've still got friends friends in my neighborhood who haven't forgiven me for, for changing it from, you know, $10 or $12 a dozen to, you know, $5 a piece.
So as a part of that, you know, I think that we just did a very quick potted history just then. But at what point, tell us a bit about the quality side of things in terms of the farming practices and stuff. You had this rundown lease that you didn't do much with at the beginning. How did you go about educating yourself on production and quality optimization and then implementing that into your practices?
Yeah, well, honestly, it was a late in life apprenticeship. And there's no other way to describe it. There were literally no books in English on oyster farming, and there's still, to be truthful, there's only a handful in English. There's a lot in French. I have a whole shelf full or two in my home library of French oyster books.
Yeah, right.
Including the history and, you know, how it developed and why it developed and the political push behind it developing, which was really people, well, before Napoleon and then de Gaulle, really, to get tourism away from Spain, and which is a mussel territory, but seafood territory. And he really, both those characters, really pushed the French industry to make oysters a French icon, basically, for tourism, to meet the tourist trade.
Mm-hmm.
So it in Australia, it's really an apprenticeship. And I had very good neighbours, very good mentors, still got them. And you change your life. First of all, your life, you throw away your watch because your life gets regulated by the tide.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn every season is different. Every year is different in seasonality and weather patterns. So there will be different impacts from different weather patterns. And, you know, you can't learn that out of a book. You've got to go through it as an experience, painful or otherwise. And little by little, the materials, the cultivation materials have changed radically since the last two decades.
Mm.
It was very, very primitive, a hangover from, you know, really the 1940s or even earlier, the old stick culture that became...
That was high, like the predominant, you know, in the 80s, everywhere. 90s, the predominant method of growing.
Yeah.
And so how has that transformed and sort of what practices did you implement?
It's pretty much, except for some pockets, some hard coat pockets, it's pretty much disappeared.
Mm.
And it's been replaced rapidly over the last 15 years by plastic culture. So there's been an explosion in the design and manufacture of plastic baskets, trays, racks, piping, you name it, which has been great to see because... Mm. The old hardwood and coatings material, it was just unsustainable.
Mm. And so is that based on quality enhancement or production enhancement?
Look, it's better for the it's everything. 1,000% better for the environment.
Right.
Probably 2,000% better for the farmer because some of the materials were very hazardous, and it's more sustainable because you're reusing those plastic. Yep. Materials, baskets, trays, whatever. And there is now design behind the shapes and sizes and the mechanics, the hydraulics of how those baskets operate.
Mm.
And that can have real outcomes in an oyster.
Were those sorts of things used in France when you first went there?
Not really. They caught their spat in a traditional way in certain areas that are abundant in spat production. But then in other areas like the Mediterranean Lagoon, where I discovered the wine, there's no spawn. It's just a 30 centimeter tide. And so there's no natural spawn. So they have to buy in spat the West Coast, bring it over to the East Coast. It was quite different. Yeah. But I was surprised to see that actually in some areas, France has actually bought Australian plastic equipment.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure that they're totally convinced of it longer term. I think they may even make their own or get alternative materials, but yeah, it did exist. I did see it in France. Yeah,
Yeah. So how these, you know, the new equipment available in the industry, and as you say, the engineering is different. There's more analysis of the different types of materials you use, the shapes, all those sorts of things. Can you give us some examples of how these things allow you to better refine your practices to enhance quality?
Well, the most obvious one is a visual one, and that's these round tumblers, about a metre and a half long, probably 300 mil in diameter. And the farmer puts juvenile spat in there, but with a foam batten on one side of this revolving thing. And the way you place it into the water is between a couple of posts. You've got multiples of these, of course. And when the tide goes up, this thing rocks up. When the tide goes down, it rocks down. You get good wind friction. And the rolling mechanism, the rolling action of this, prohibits the oysters from joining together in their natural cement, if you like.
Right.
And so each oyster becomes its own little single seed, and that's the term the technique's referred as. It's a bit like marbles, you know, the old marbles, and they all become like marbles, basically. There are still front runners and slow runners, and then after every 3 months or so, these things actually grow, but they're growing with this beautiful curvature.
Mm.
And the farmer then thins them out, sticks the excess into another one, and so on and so on, and you continue on.
Yeah, okay.
So one of our most popular brands is the Moonlight Kiss, and it's really eye candy.
Mm.
And it appeals to the new demographic that we're aiming for, or that we found during some of our workshops and masterclasses, and that is the young female demographic.
Okay.
Because this oyster is less threatening, less intimidating, less of a gamble, and it looks cute.
Yeah.
It's like half a golf ball or a little bit smaller, and it is. It's really quite cute.
Yeah.
And we have many imitators now.
A nice shape. And so that gives it a you know, an aesthetic quality. What about, I'd like to sort of dive into a bit about what impacts the, you know, the flavor of oysters and quality on that level.
Yeah.
And there are so many. And what you can, because the product is such a, I mean, oysters are such a product of the environment. And you, as an oyster farmer, have the ability where possible to be able to, you know, implement practices to optimize quality in response to environmental conditions. Yep. So I want to dive into that a little bit. So maybe as a start, give us an indication of some of the things that do, some of the natural, you know, impacts on oysters.
Okay. Well, a decade and a half through the apprenticeship, on one of our trips, several trips to France now, we discovered the green oyster, with revert, whereby the French actually place oysters into a pond about the size of what we know in Australia as a dam out on a property. And in this dam, the farmers have placed a blue algae, which they can possess under license from the EU regulatory authorities. And this occurs in one major area which produces 25% of French's oysters, the Marine Oloron. They place their Pacific oysters, all oysters, pretty much 98% of oysters in France are Pacifics these days because the native ones died out. Place their Pacifics in there, and as the oyster picks up this blue algae, it turns the flesh green.
Mm-hmm.
Then depending on the stocking density, the depth and the duration, the longevity in those ponds, it will influence the greenness And the greenness, it doesn't taste any different in my view. Maybe a French thing. But on the menu, it actually commands a premium.
Yeah.
Depending on the greenness.
Yeah.
Well, it's very French. And so now they've taken the lesson from the wine industry and wine labelling, and this hugely crisscross net of cobweb of appellations and terms and, you know, Grand Cru, Premier Grand Cru, yeah, and all of this rubbish, and tied themselves in knots. It's not as bad as the wine labelling, but it's heading that way.
Yeah,
and that's a French thing. That's fine.
It's,
you know,
very French, isn't it?
And if they make a premium more, you know, that's great. But the impact of that, to me, the lesson for that, very deep lesson for that, was you can influence the outcome of an oyster.
Yeah.
And secondly, the critical role of algae.
Yes.
And honestly, I'm just now embarking on some fairly serious investigation, my personal investigation myself, talking to algae labs about the range of algae that are available, are found in the water, and some good, some bad, but, you know, is there a predominance of one that correlates with fatter oysters or waxing oysters? And just see if we can, I don't think, number one, we can't control nature. But maybe if we monitor it, I can tell when oysters should be good or coming into a fatter season. And of course, talking about fatter condition, a fatter season, is another lesson from France. And that is that, unlike Australia, where the belief is the only good oyster is a busting fat oyster, the French abhor that.
And yeah, right.
Absolutely. And I have in my kit bag photographs taken from marketplaces that say, you know, the fresh oysters, nice, crunchy, nice, nutty, fleshy flavour, which is the preferred range of flavour, not milky, non laitous. And Australians in the industry don't understand that.
Mm.
And why not? Because there's an old traditional furphy, and this is a marketing furphy between the middlemen and the farmer. So the farmer sends off his or her oysters in full expectation that they'll get paid. But if a devious person opens them and can get and looks at them and says, oh, well, you know, they're sort of half full or three quarters full, but he gets 50 cents cheaper oysters from another origin, he'll ring up farmer number one and say, oh, no, sorry, your oysters are too poor, take them back and we're not going to pay you.
Mm.
So the summer condition, this furphy about the summer condition, totally fat with spawn, is an Australian furphy.
Yeah, okay.
Mm.
And God, how do you find yourself in your position selling to a market who prefers that, but you sort of, you know, being on a different wavelength when
it's
comes
fine.
To your opinion of...
It's fine so long as your chefs are not pure French.
Yeah, okay, right.
But I honestly have had two chefs in the last 10 years call me and say, there's something wrong with these oysters.
Oh, really?
They're milking everywhere, you know. they're too gross. And we just look at each other on the lease and say, well, you know, welcome to Australia.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, those French chefs. Before we move off quality, let's talk a bit about how you assess quality when you're tasting your own oysters or you're preparing them for distribution.
So as a rough guideline, what we used to tell people in our masterclasses was, and still do, there are really about five or six factors that go to make up or influence the outcome of the flesh in an oyster and taste and flavour. And basically, they are hydrology, botany, geology, salinity, and basically rainfall and sunlight. So hydrology means where the oysters are placed in the estuary, and every estuary is different. You've got fast-moving estuaries, you've got slow-moving estuaries like Turos, You got and this that's an important factor, not only for the depth but the flow rate. That'll influence the shell strength. But it also will affect the recovery after a big downpour. And that's important from a commercial point of view. As a farm, you need to keep going, not, you know, be held up for a month while the salinity recovers. Botany is very easy, and there are certain estuaries that have a botanical signature, like Nambucca oysters have this really strong, greeny, vegetative kind of flavour if you're subtle enough. And it's because they've got forests of mangrove swamp all around, really, really thick mangroves, very, very distinctive. And I think it also puts a bit of a slightly creamy yellow colour to the oyster. It's quite pleasant. So we've got mangroves, we've got river weed, estuary weed, and you've got seaweed if you're near an ocean mouth. So that's another one. We did an experiment years ago for the Slow Food Society, and we put 20 dozen oysters in a weed bed up a few kilometres up in the Clyde, left them there for 2 weeks, brought them out, sent them down with a control group for them to try. And to a person, they could all identify blind, they could identify the weed influence in the flesh of the oyster. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't taste very good, so, but I wouldn't do it. I mean, you wouldn't do it commercially.
No. Yeah.
Geology is whether the oysters are over shale, mud, sand, whatever. The influence is, you know, pretty self-explanatory. Salinity is probably the most important one, and that's when you're traveling. What every tourist should be looking for, keeping an eye on, is whether the area has recently had a deluge, which will drop the salinity in the water, which will drop the salinity in the oyster. And salinity really is the zing in the oyster. You know, you really need some salinity there as a background, not overpowering. Rainfall or salinity or lack of salinity is pretty important. You don't want insipid teabag oysters, okay? And just to mark the legality of it, after a deluge of rain, every estuary has a threshold, after which, say, 20 mils, 30 mils of rain, then the Food Authority, it's an automatic closure of harvest until that salinity recovers. And we do testing to make sure that's happened. And the other one is sunshine. So sunlight, obviously, warms the surface of the water. So when you go for a swim, you know the surface is warmer than the bottom. And that generates the plankton and the microalgae that the oysters pump. And so a very, very clear example of this I saw in France, where growing flat oysters in France around in Brittany, in the Port de Bellon, where the Bellon originated, it would take them 10 years, 9 to 10 years, to grow quite a big flat oyster that in Australia would take 3 years.
Right.
Because of the sunlight and the water temperature.
It's
quite a distinctive thing.
Yeah.
And also it can affect the colours, so that if you've got flat oysters submerged 100% of the time, they won't get a greeny tinge. If you've got them intertidal or semi-intertidal, they'll eventually get a lovely green algal sort of colour on the outside. So there's a lot going on in there.
And so the interesting thing about what you've just told me is that so much of your assessment of quality is based on the natural conditions. I mean, other than salinity, we haven't really talked about the taste of them yet.
So all of those factors should give a balance.
Right.
And I guess, and it's like wine. It's subjective, totally subjective.
Yeah, okay.
And the other part, the other angle to your question should be, why do some people like Pacific and not Sydney Rock, or vice versa?
Yeah.
And to be honest, the only honest answer I can come up with that one is, I think our palate grows up accumulating an expectation of what an oyster tastes like. So people in Tasmania growing up from scratch, or in France growing up from scratch, have only tasted a Pacific oyster.
Mm.
And the dynamics of that flavour is what their tongue or palate expects. Whereas for me, a Pacific oyster is really industrial.
Yeah.
Very industrial. I could not sit down and eat. When we lived in Japan, I'd go down to Mitsukoshi and get some Pacific oysters, and I couldn't get through more than two or three.
Yeah.
I just couldn't hack it. And that's not... It's not to say they're bad or, you know, they haven't got a market. They have. That's the most universal oyster around the world for a whole host of reasons. But it's just a different flavour expectation.
Mm.
So it's unfair to sit up and say, oh, well, you know, there's only Sydney Rock oysters and the rest. When I go to France, I have to eat Pacific oysters. But the Atlantic oyster is... not such a bad oyster.
Yeah, okay.
Especially when you've got a good wine.
Yeah, exactly. It makes it a lot easier if you've had a few. All right, fascinating. I want to move on to a bit more about the story of Moonlight Flat and how you've, you know, put yourself in the position that you are now. Tell us a bit about who was the first chef you supplied?
Yvonne Meunier at the Boathouse in Sydney. So when I used to come back to Australia as an expatriate from North Asia and the Boathouse just opened in 1998, I think, and we'd read it in the Gourmet Traveller or whatever. And so I'd go there for a meal to try the seafood because I love seafood. And the whole place just... resonated. Dark timber floors, point blank working harbour little area. The fish markets were straight over there.
Yeah.
It just hummed. And I just sat there in bliss and thought, this is the place. This is my kind of joint. I want to supply this place. And a little later on, you know, back to Japan, then came back again and sent them a... I think I might have had a conversation with one of the floor managers and said, oh, you know, we've got these oysters, you know, I'd like to just send you some, see how you go. And they said, yeah, very enthusiastic. And the short story is we sent them the first batch back in 99 or 98 and we got a fax. People had faxes back in those days. Fax back overnight saying, send more.
Yeah,
they're nice. Delicious. Okay. Terrific. Send more. And so that's how it started. And from that time on, number one, we had the most wonderful partnership with the Boathouse, Glebe. We did masterclasses there every year for the Good Food Month for 16 years. Wonderful owners, wonderful series of chefs. Yvonne, French guy, was a wonderful mentor in a lot of things, oysters and non-oysters. He's still around. He's down in Melbourne these days. And so the partnership began and word of mouth happened. And so every inquiry, every next customer was a word of mouth thing. And Sydney or New South Wales was our principal market for 6 years. Until Melbourne heard about us and a couple of visiting chefs who came up from Melbourne called us up and said, oh, we've got to get your stuff. And I said, yeah, I'm very happy, but I'm not convinced about the logistics. And if I'm not happy about the logistics, you're not going to be happy about the product you get. So when I do a bit more homework and can find somebody really reliable and massage them and tell them, you know, how to look after this stuff in a friendly fashion, not like... and why it has to be,
yeah,
you know, carefully handled, then we'll do business. And eventually, it was a long haul, I did find a company that was reliable, could be educated, but schooled. And Melbourne became 70% of our market.
Yeah, there you go. There's a couple of things here. At what point did you decide, this is what I want to do? I want to... only supply chefs?
Oh, from the beginning.
Right.
Absolutely. For reasons that I've mentioned before, you don't have admixture.
Yeah.
You don't have funny business going on. The middle area, and I do have one or two friends in the middle area, I've got to say, but that's a different story again. Probably got a few enemies too, but it's not a, there's not a commission on either side of the transaction. Yeah. So the farmer's getting a better, truer, more accurate return. The chef is getting cheaper, but higher quality or guaranteed quality. And I mean, we guarantee our stuff. If you don't like, if they don't like it, we'll recredit or refund or whatever. It's all a reputation. It's been all a reputation business and still is a reputation business. Mm. 2 weeks ago, I had to call a trading halt for the first time in 21 years because I wasn't satisfied. We weren't satisfied with the quality.
Mm.
It never happened before, but we've had those two deluges of 200 mils each. And the poor old oysters couldn't handle it. And I've never seen them looking so sad.
Mm.
And if I'm not happy, the chef's not going to be happy.
Yeah, of course. When you first started supplying the Boathouse back in the late 90s, did you at this point already have branded oysters? Because yours were definitely the first I saw with... Which was the first to be branded? Was it the Clair de Lune?
Yeah, to be formally branded, it was the Clair de Lune. And... 1999, yeah. And it's still going, and it would be, honestly, be the most menued oyster in Australia.
Yeah.
No question about it. Mm. Yeah. Very happy. Since then, we've got the Petit Clair, the Moonlight Kiss, Rusty Wire. That's a bit of a zinger.
Yeah.
Very memorable.
Yeah.
A bit of a mnemonic there.
Is that still around, the Rusty Wire?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
and the Label Rouge.
Yeah, okay. Fantastic. And then did you see... Because I remember when I think the first time that I ever came across your oysters was probably at one of Andrew McConnell's restaurants in Melbourne.
Yeah, very likely.
And they listed the name of this Clair de Lune, and it says Moonlight Flat Clair de Lune, Moonlight Flat Rusty Wire, and it's so interesting to someone who's interested in food and has only seen oysters, you know, Sydney Rock oysters, half a dozen this much, full dozen this much. And they were sold by the piece.
Yeah.
I sort of remember just thinking, Jesus, what's this? Like, you know, and for a chef to put the name of your business and the type of oyster on your menu, and there's two different ones available for this from this same supplier, is fascinating.
Revolutionary.
And
bit of a gamble and revolutionary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so did you, I mean, when, tell us a bit about how you noticed your brand getting recognized by chefs and starting to see chefs approaching you saying, look, we've seen your product on these menus. And
well, to be honest, it really was just a lesson from Japan. Brand identity, brand articulation. And as I said before, the brand's got to stand for something. And if the brand does stand for something, then the customer adhesion increases proportionately. So brand strength and you know, I was determined to bring to the market a brand and a quality that would be beyond question.
Mm.
And as we've discussed previously about dodgy oysters in the marketplace, what's a chef want? He wants just what a flour miller wants, consistency.
Mm.
Same, you know, if you're sitting down with six people around a table, it's no good having one poor oyster, two good ones, another bad one, a small one, an ugly one, a lopsided one, and one that stinks, right? They've all got to be the same.
Yeah.
Or close. So there's consistency from week to week to week to week to week to week. And that's our life challenge. And when we're out harvesting, you know, and I look at this stuff, or when we're packing or sorting or grading, I used to feel Shannon Bennett's eye over my shoulder or Andrew McConnell's eye over my shoulder. And I'm thinking, would he want this? Would he be happy with this?
Yeah.
If he's not happy with that, if he's not happy with that, customer's not going to be happy. And that product consistency, that product quality is not going to be there. In Japan, and where do you get these highfalutin ideas about product quality? I looked at cantaloupe in a Japanese supermarket, you know, the Mitsukoshi or the Takashi Maya, and they're $60 or $100 a piece, one piece.
Yeah.
And of course, it's perfect, perfectly shaped, perfectly groomed, and in a nice little box, presentation box. But it's the customer purchase experience that gives that customer enjoyment. It's not just the cantaloupe. It's a visual thing. And when you're buying something of quality, it's that transactional experience that hooks people.
Yeah, it's such a big part of it. And I think that when it comes to any ingredient, any produce, that's a lot of that can be missed. And with with recognized brands, now we're seeing it throughout different agricultural industries or aquacultural industries, and I think it's proliferated with social media as well. But any of these recognized brands, you think about something like, you know, Blackmores Wagyu, or even, you know, things like yuzu that they grow in Tassie and stuff like that. That transactional experience is so different. The brand, the way that it's... I mean, I saw someone open a Blackmores Wagyu, you know, whatever it was, like it was like a whole fillet or something like that. And it was, as you say, like in Japan, in a box with beautiful material inside there. It was like this beautiful boutique experience. And yeah, if that's not there, then the price isn't commanded and the brand recognition isn't the same.
Let me give you another example from Japan.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
Sticks indelibly in my mind that we were there when one of the princes got married, and his bride was I think she was a commoner. I think she came from the foreign service, actually. But when she got married, the wedding outfit was 7 layers of clothing, all ceremonial.
Mm.
7 layers of packaging.
Yeah.
Does that tell anything about what's important in Japan?
Yeah. It's a different story, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah. And so that same sort of thing is, you know, throughout oysters in Japan as well?
Oysters are marketed differently in Japan. Yeah. The Mitsukoshi example that I mentioned before, which is like David Jones Food Hall, they were actually pre-shucked but vacuum sealed in a plastic open packet thing.
Mm.
And while it was a hygienic, and frankly, I had no alternative, so that was a easy access to oysters. But as I said before, I couldn't go beyond 3 oysters.
Yeah.
If you go down to, I used to go to Skidgee Market every Saturday for 4 years. Skidgee Market was, you know, the razzle dazzle of seafood in Tokyo. And it was real fun and real international seafood from all over. New Zealand snapper, for example. And I developed friends, vendors who were doing prawns or stretching eels out with a nail in the head, stretch them out and then gut them. It was just unbelievable. But the oysters used to be in huge pails, maybe 10 litre or 20 litre pails, and they'd be just all, you know, opened and pre-shucked and put in there. And that was for the downstream market.
Mm-hmm.
So oysters in that region are not, even in Korea and definitely in China, are not intended for raw consumption piece by piece.
Yeah,
they may be today, I don't know. But they're more intended for the steaming, frying, soy sauce, oyster sauce, shabu shabu, all of that sort of cooking market.
Mm.
And that's fine. That's their culture.
Yeah. Cool. I just mentioned social media, but let's dwell on it a little bit. What I'm seeing now is, I think when I first came across your products, and you know, you'd come across other ones, brand recognition, but brand recognition came from menus basically a lot of the time, and you know, you could go to your website and check it out and stuff like that. So you're in this interesting space where you were kind of the only story told in a way, because you were mentioned on the menu and it was recognizable. But now with social media, everyone has the ability to tell their own story.
Yep.
And I think that chefs are now educating their audience. And the funny thing about how, you know, the nature of celebrity chefism, if you will, has changed, was that before you had to have a TV show and a cookbook, but now you can kind of be a celebrity chef and just be a well-regarded chef at a high-quality establishment that has a good Instagram following.
Absolutely, I've seen that too.
Yeah, so do you want to just, like, maybe tell me a little bit about how you've seen that change and how the ability for other... First, we'll start with the public being able to be educated even further on your products via social media and via the chefs and things like that, and how that might have changed the way the public demands your product.
Somebody in, I think one of my rare friends in the fish market said to me the other day, and it's very true, is that to be a chef today, there are now Instagram chefs,
yeah,
not food chefs. And I think that's very true. But it doesn't worry me because our oyster reputation depends on quality, not notoriety or publicity. And I'm happy to have, you know, I've spent a lot of money on, you know, photography with the website and other areas. That's fine, but our focus remains on the quality, because chefs will come and go. We've seen that. Instagram will come and go, or trends will come and go. But I'm after hooking the customer who wants to return to an Andrea McConnell restaurant time and time and time again because they have confidence in the brand, or St. Peter, or Fred's, or Mox, any of these, you know, big names. They know the brands. The Kiss is almost iconic through St. Peter now in Fish Butchery. Like the wine, I'm just ever so pleased. One of the greatest rewards is to see our product take off and the marketing work with the Kiss and the wine, the Picpoul Blanc, in St. Peter since day one. And I mean, that guy is a genius. I have seen many chefs, all the big chefs. I've dealt with all the big name chefs over 21 years. Some of them are not with us anymore, and that's fine. But the creativity and the expertise of this young fellow is just brilliant. You know, you don't win a James Beard cookbook award by just plodding along or being an Instagram chef. That's like the Nobel Prize what do you call it, an Oscar, right? But it's not, and there is, how many chefs in Australia have ever won the James Beard?
None.
One.
Oh, one?
Josh Nyland. Josh.
Yeah. Yeah, it is amazing. And yeah, well, what a testament to what chefs, I think it's a wonderful testament to the power that chefs have to be able to change public perception about things now.
Yeah.
And I really do think that chefs are at the forefront, or they have the ability to educate across so many different things when it comes to sustainability and all these different things that are encompassed by what he's doing,
especially in a difficult area like seafood, like fish.
Yeah.
You know, we just don't have talent that is prepared to knuckle down and do the guts and all stuff that he does.
Yeah, exactly.
It's unbelievable.
It's so fascinating because you kind of look back at it now and, you know, you take the premise that fish are a 50% waste product.
Yeah.
And the fact that no one really before thought, well, hold on, let's just look at this 50% waste and see what we can do with it to the absolute nth degree.
Yeah.
You know, it's a no-brainer in hindsight.
Yeah.
But you know, to do it with the
techniques that Josh is bringing to the art, the microsurgery.
Mm.
And I keep thinking, and I mentioned to him that he really should go to Japan and see what the microsurgeons there do.
Yeah.
I mean, he's doing better. He's doing equal and better than they are. But
yeah.
Just this dedication and respect for the seafood, to see people doing sashimi very, very thinly, to surgically prepare the fungu, the poisonous Japanese fish. You know, you have to have a... You have to have a license to be a fungu chef, right? And that's basically what Josh isn't doing, poisonous fish, but that's the level of detail, that microscopic detail that he's doing. Yeah.
With, you know, back to social media, and I think that there are a lot of other oyster growers who have now sort of, you know, enhanced their marketing and branding and are more recognizable and things like that. Is it a more competitive marketplace for you now?
It is. It's a bit of a wry moment when I read my own vocabulary being regurgitated. That's been interesting. But look, I'm comfortable with where we're at and what we've done. We still get inquiries based on our reputation. So just out of the blue, we've never advertised. And we don't have to push hard in that regard. Yep. There's a lot of noise out there in the marketplace, which will be seen through in the longer term.
Yeah.
But you, I mean, we're after a quality product and a reputation. That's where we're at.
Yeah. And it seems to me that you're, despite, you know, being, doing it for a couple of decades or more, you're still pushing quality and you know, you're not just sort of resting saying we're in a good place. As you say, you're still doing investigations constantly about algae, like you mentioned before, and that sort of thing.
I'm intrigued by algae, and I'm convinced that algae is one of the foods of the future, really, with a big role. I mean, somebody approached me to talk at some food conference, an actual food conference, about foods of the future, and I said there are two. I said we don't need to talk about it. It's lupins, lentils, and algae, basically. That's where food will be. So if you want to make an investment, try and make it around those. We have some very clever people doing algae stuff here, right here in the South Coast.
Yeah, have you spoke to Pia up in Nowra?
Yeah, many years ago.
Yeah,
and if I had time and wasn't into the oysters, I would, you know, be collaborating, hopefully collaborating with her or pursuing, but she's done some wonderful stuff.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Algal noodles. But just so we have an algae naturally that occurring in the South Coast, this sea lettuce, and it occurs throughout Europe as well. And I just find that fascinating. We harvest it. We have a license to harvest. We dry it out and then desiccate it and use it for home use.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But I used to sell that to Andrew McConnell restaurants for years until they learned to do it themselves, go and get it themselves.
Yeah, well, there's people out there doing it now.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you've ever been on any rock platform at low tide,
yeah,
on the South Coast, you'll see what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Favourite food of a lot of the, you know, Luderick and local fish in the area as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Let's move on to wine,
because
it's a fascinating story. Let's just do it. Just launch in, Steve. Tell us about your wine.
Well, when we were talking about the oysters, I mentioned that we have been going to France every year for, I don't know, 13, 14, 15 years, looking at various oyster areas to, you know, see how it's done and see what we can learn. And on one trip, we were down on the Languedoc coast, in the Mediterranean side, a little oyster town called Bouzigues, which is, I love it, my wife hates it, but it's within a stone's throw of some wine of vineyards. You can actually see them. And indeed, this was a barbecue thing, and they were burning vine roots and stumps. And I thought, geez, that's pretty luxurious. Anyway, it turns out they're all of this wine grape that I discovered. So sitting down, having an oyster and a fish or something, all pretty low tech, wasn't a swanky sort of upmarket restaurant. Anyway, waiter sort of strolls over in that lovely, nonchalant southern country style and just tips the wine into the glass. Went away, didn't show me the bottle. And so I'm continuing busy with the oysters, and I took a sip of the wine. And wow, my head just about blew off. It was so good. And I've always found it very difficult to find a white wine that I really, really, really enjoy. Can't put down.
Mm.
And I think I found it. And so immediately I thought, oh my God, I've got to get this for our oyster portfolio for our customers to just complement the whole of table experience. You know, the oyster plus the matching wine.
Mm.
So called the waiter back over, had a look at the label, Picpoul de Pinay. Pinay is a little village in the south. Never heard of this variety. Came back home, Googled like crazy, couldn't find it anywhere, couldn't find a trace of it in Australia. And I thought, here's a challenge. I can do this, I hope. So a couple of years strategy of how to get in touch with a grower, and that was helped by a friend, a French professor friend from Canberra, who paved the way, rang the guy in the middle of the night and said, I've got a crazy friend who wants to come over and borrow some cuttings from you. Didn't get a great response. A couple of years later, on the next trip, deliberately in the middle of dead of winter, there we were banging down from Paris down to Montpellier, snow on either side, but teams of people out pruning vineyards, and I thought, this is great. I thought, here I am going to ask a guy I've never met in a language that's not mine to please hand over some intellectual property.
Yeah. And a what, Frenchman.
What? Exactly. Mission yeah. Impossible.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we got out, got there, drove, went, got a car down to Nézignan-l'Évêque, met the guy, explained what I wanted. I had two photographs. I took two photographs with me. One was a photograph of a paddock of canola on a property that we owned at that time at Cowra. And the other photograph was a photo of our oyster leases. And I said to him in my best franglais, je vais la terre, je vais la désuire, but ma pas désolé, not pas the pig pool. And I knew he got it. And he knew what it was about. So he sort of gestured something different, and we jumped in his car and we went to his vineyard, where he expounded on the virtues and how the mist comes in the evening, and they don't irrigate, which is great. And there's a lot of pilgrim trails around this area. It's a very historic area. And anyway, long story short, I had to grab him by the elbow and say, look, I've come a long way. I'd like to get some cuttings, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
And he fell for it. No, he succumbed. He is a very nice guy. And so he ordered his guys to cut some cuttings, give me some cuttings. And I, at that stage, I just levitated off the ground a meter or two. And he gave me 7 cuttings. And so I came home. Well, I had all the permits and that payments and everything for quarantine. Not a problem. Came home, surrendered them, and then they went for 3 years in quarantine. They, you don't get the originals back, you get the grandchildren back. They do cultivation after cultivation.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And put them through 50 degree centigrade temperatures, so there's no question of disease. God, yeah. God forbid that I would be responsible for the death of the vine industry in Australia. No. It's okay. 3 years in quarantine in Sydney, out of Sydney, and then 2 years. So what you get back is three bushes. That's, can't do much with that. So down to a plant laboratory in the Dandenongs for another 2 years, where they multiply them up through magical methods that I'd never seen before. And 9 months inside a laboratory with controlled climate and atmosphere, 9 months out in the real world, sunshine and wind and rain. And so we ended up with about 200 400 500, which I then multiplied up here in Batemans Bay. I potted and propagated, and I eventually planted out 800 vines in trenches containing oyster shell, which I thought was pretty
perfect
out at Cowra. And they did extremely well when we had water. But when we didn't have water and in the middle of a drought, you can't get a bore driller for love nor money, because they're all too busy, doing multi-million dollar properties. So I decided I needed water, and I needed an established vigneron who knew what they were doing, as opposed to myself. And so down the lane, a couple of kilometres, there was a vineyard called Windari Wines. So I rang the owner, or the principal guy, cold. And when he answered the phone, I said, do you like oysters? And this voice came back, love oysters. I said, oh, good. Now, let me tell you what it's about, who I am, what all this. And so it just kicked off from there. And we grafted 3,000 vines onto old Vidella rootstock, and he grows, or the winery, the vineyard grows under contract for us, and we're now into our fourth year.
Yeah.
So that's how it got off the ground.
So fourth, when was the first vintage?
4 years ago. So from March, 4 years ago.
17.
Yeah, we had a little vintage in 17, and we put that all in half bottles.
Okay.
And it disappeared in an eye blink.
Yeah.
It was good. It's been an interesting marketing exercise. The original label featured a young woman opening an oyster in a wealthy Dutch merchant's house, 17th century Dutch master painting, which I thought was terrific. And the same photograph, the same picture, sorry, was on all our oyster boxes yep. at that time. And then I got to thinking, well, Steve, you're a dunce. You know that in Australia, only 20% of people want anything to do with oysters, right? So why are you trying to ram down people's throat a wine with a picture of oysters on it?
Yeah.
It's a seafood wine, right? And it's a seafood wine in its home country. Mm. It's just that it's grown near a lot of oyster, funny oyster cultivation area where they grow them on trellises, actually, in the water. So we won't go into that rabbit hole. So I thought we need to genericize the label, and that's what we did in the last two vintages.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, we just happened to strike it at the time in the labeling industry where they came out with a new product. And I don't know if you've seen it, but there's two fish and the scales are yep. sort of opalescent. And it's a little bit dark in that, you know, some of the flesh is missing off the skeleton. And that's just an inspiration from the fish butchery.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Tell us about Pickpool and what is it about this wine that yeah. pairs so well with oysters?
Yeah. So it's been around for a long, long, long time. Medieval texts mention it. And the area is quite famous for it, especially during those serious pilgrim days. But there's only 1,100 hectares grown, and it's a very limited area. And it's shrinking because the government's about to put a new TGV line right down through the middle of it. There's three major co-ops. 80% of the stuff is sold through the co-ops. I think there's about 22 or 30 vineyards that grow. But the fascinating thing from a market point of view is that it's enjoyed an astonishing success in London, or in the UK, but principally London, where it has grown 1,500% in 5 years
wow.
between 2010 and 2015. And the very logical reason for that is middle-class Londoners go down to the south of France for their summer holidays and some seafood, and they've discovered it.
Yep.
And gone back to London and said to their Waitrose and the others, where's this wine? Why haven't you got it in? And so there's been a stampede at all levels, you know, from ritzy restaurants right down, where it's just, you know, caught fire as the partner of seafood.
Yep.
So I was able to tap into a couple of British people who actually make the wine in France as well. Mm-hmm. They're very clever people. And one guy did his MW, Master of Wine, dissertation on the rise of Pickpool of the market in Britain, especially in London. And God love him, I asked for, and he sent me a copy of his dissertation. And amongst the important points of that is one that the supermarkets can't get enough, or the markets can't get enough, and they're looking for alternative sources of supply. So we're here waving our hands in the air. And I've started sending samples, started competing in competitions over there, and lucky, we got a bronze medal in decanter competition. And decanter is the biggest in the world, 16,500 entries, 121 judges. And I think there were five pick pools entered. We beat one huge French name. We equaled two others, and we came second by 1 point.
Wow.
I'm pretty happy about
that. Yeah, that's very happy about that.
Yeah. It jumps the credibility gap.
Yeah.
For any doubters.
Yeah.
Just in an instant. You don't have to say anything. You just look at it, or you look at the medal on the bottle.
Yeah.
And just a month ago, we got another one in a different competition, International Wine Challenge in London. And again, you know, not many wines get mentioned, but we got a recommended award.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Perfect.
We have won medals here in Australia too at Wine State in Adelaide. We got best in class emerging and alternative varieties and best value.
Yeah, amazing. And so, I mean, let's quickly get into the characteristics of Pickpool, because I reckon the majority of people listening to this mightn't have tasted it yet, and what that is that does pair with, I mean, apart from the story, because the story is such a big part of it. But
well, exactly, the mechanics of how it works with seafood, or specifically oysters, is this: when you eat an oyster and you macerate it a little bit, it leaves a bit of a filmy, chalky thing around your mouth and your palate and your saliva and the walls of your mouth, which we all know you can taste 15 minutes later, basically. Mm. And what the Pickpool does, so it's citrusy, flinty, minerally, puckish. When you take a sip of the Pickpool after the oyster, that citrusy stuff sort of reacts or cleans the walls and the tongue, and it reacts with that residue of the oyster. So you can actually, if you concentrate, you can actually feel it happening. And that's the physical matching, the physical experience that I am just thrilled about, and I'm sure, I hope more people will enjoy. Yeah. Mm. But equally, and this is a wonderful experience of bringing an old world wine into a new world environment, it's a fantastic standalone aperitif on a sunny afternoon in place of a beer.
Yep.
And it's lower alcohol, as you chill it down just like champagne on ice to 8 degrees, which is happens to be the great temperature that oysters should be served at, and it works. And so I'm really, really happy. And you know, unlike Britain, we have heaps of sunshine, heaps of great seafood, and readily available. So,
and so, how have you sort of gotten it out there, and what's the response been like to this point four vintages later?
So originally we went through our restaurants, of course, and great supporters, and we need great supporters to have that confidence to go from year to year to year to year. So for people like St. Peter, and there's just no better flagship to have our seafood wine than in Australia's leading seafood house. So that kind of support has been absolutely terrific. And just recently, we've been available through Dan's Online for 2 years, and that's been okay. But recently I was able to find the correct guy in Dan's fine wines category who just got it. He just understood exactly what we're doing, why we're doing, and where this wine fits into the future. And he's very excited. And so we're going out into bricks and mortar, I think next week or the week, in the next 2 weeks anyway, all throughout New South Wales and the ACT. We had a very successful exposure at the Naruma Oyster Festival recently, where this wine was the official events wine. And we sold probably 10 or 12 dozen in 60ml and 120ml taster glasses. That's a lot of little tasters. So that's pegging. And Bateman's Bay, Dan Murphy, was given permission to stock the wine before the official rollout, but to coincide with the Naruma event. And honestly, they have been just going through like butter. It's just walking off the shelf.
Great.
They're very happy. I'm very happy. I've spoken to three outlets in Canberra who all know it and just can't wait. I've spoken to the nearest Dan's to the fish market in Sydney, who has worked at Windowry, knows the product, has followed me or our products for years, can't wait to get it.
Fantastic. Mm. Good news. And I think that when it comes to lesser known varietals, you know, looking at it from a wine context, the mission for, you know, wine importers or distributors trying to get these lesser known varieties across the line is such a challenge in a marketplace where there's so much, and people are now, you know, they're intrigued to different wines and things like that to another level in today's marketplace. Yep. and your ability to connect the wine to the oysters and to the story and things like that has it's such a great success of how a story, how a narrative and this type of work can succeed.
It's been very rewarding to see the market take it with the story. But we have two new chapters to address, and one is we hope to have a sparkling version by the end of the year, which will really be a zinger, especially lower alcohol. But the marketing data kings at Dan's tell me this is where it's at, this is where we're going to go, and the future is very exciting. They see that future is very, very exciting, which is all good. So a third of this year's production will go to sparkling.
Yep.
And the second barrel is I'm absolutely committed to get this wine into London.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
I want an export arm of this to take 50% of production as soon as we can crack it. But with COVID, Brexit, everything else, it's interesting time.
Well, we've got some new trade deals that might work in your favour well there, Steve.
Exactly right.
Well, fantastic. Steve, it's been amazing to chat because, just having the benefit of time on our hands to go through all this has been a privilege and a pleasure. So, mate, thank you so much for joining me on the Food Plot.
Absolute pleasure. And great. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Yeah, and if you're out there, you know, hopefully coming soon to a Dan Murphy's near you, the pit pole.
Or you can get it online or you can get it direct. Yeah. Check the website. We do Instagram, but we've been a little bit quiet in the last month because of COVID and whatever.
Yeah.
But
you can Google Moonlight Flat and you'll find everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. Thanks, Steve. Yeah. Cheers, mate. Cheers. Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.